From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Richard Alpert first became known as the Harvard professor who experimented with LSD. Then he became known as spiritual leader Baba Ramdas. On today's Fresh Air, Ramdas tells us why he got rid of his robes and his beard, and how he started pursuing service as a form of spiritual discipline. Also today, how the Catskills became the Borscht Belt. Stefan Kanfer has written a history of the Catskill Mountains and their celebrated resort hotels. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers how some of today's well-known rock groups got their start at the New York club CBGB's. And TV critic David Bianculli considers the image of each of the major networks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev announced today that the Soviet Union was prepared to accept the membership of a united Germany in the Western NATO alliance. Gorbachev's statement came at a joint press conference with West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, summing up 2 days of intensive talks over what's been the major obstacle to German unification. Benjamin Leroux reports.
"I promise you interesting remarks," Gorbachev said as he opened the briefing, and he did not disappoint. In the southern spa resort of Mineralny Vody, he made the historic announcement that he has tenaciously resisted for months. "Whether we like it or not," he began, "the time will come when a united Germany will be in NATO if that is its choice. Then, if that is the choice, to some degree and in some form, it can work together with the Soviet Union." Gorbachev added that NATO's recent declaration that it no longer considers the Soviet Union its enemy helped sway his decision, but asserted that neither country got all that it wished for in the negotiations. The Soviet leader said he expected a grace period of up to 4 years to withdraw Soviet troops from East Germany and a drastic reduction in the size of a united German military force. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
The White House issued a new estimate of next year's budget deficit today. It's 2/3 higher than the administration projection just 6 months ago. The new figure is $169 billion, or $231 billion if you count the cost of the savings and loan bailout. White House Budget Director Richard Darman warned that without a budget agreement between Congress and the administration, there could be unprecedented, automatic, across-the-board spending cuts. He outlined a series of potential cuts in high-profile programs. Darman said airport control towers could be closed, student loans canceled, and as many as 1 million people furloughed from the military. At least 40 people were murdered and 20 wounded in the Colombian city of Medellin over the weekend. 4 policemen were killed, but the majority of the victims were young men from the city's slums. Leslie Werpsa reports from Bogota.
The rash of violence this weekend in Medellin began on Saturday evening when a car bomb exploded in the center of the city near a police station. That night, gunmen killed 23 people in the slums. 3 people, for example, were taken from a party and murdered. In March, drug baron Pablo Escobar offered to pay $4,400 for each policeman killed in Medellin. 192 agents have been murdered since then. More recently, though, squadrons of killers began to wage a series of collective killings of young men in the slums. The poor areas are considered breeding grounds for hired killers who work for the drug cartels. A law enforcement official in Medellin said the city residents believe that the police are killing the youth in the slums to avenge the murders of their colleagues. The authorities' motto is, "No more hired killers, drug traffickers, or delinquents in our land." For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
The Dow gained 20 points to close at a record 29.99. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest has made an impact on American culture through his early experiments with LSD and as a spiritual leader. In the early 1960s, Richard Alpert was a Harvard professor of psychology, conducting clinical research into the use of psychedelics. He and his colleague, Timothy Leary, were fired from Harvard in 1963. After continuing the experiments off campus, in 1967, Alpert went to India, where he met his guru and studied yoga and meditation. His spiritual teacher gave him a new name, Ramdas. And when Ramdas returned to the States, he was perceived as something of a guru himself. His 1971 book of advice, Be Here Now, became a bestseller. Now Ramdas describes himself as pursuing service as a form of spiritual discipline. In 1978, he co-founded the group SIVA, a service organization that supports health and environmental organizations in developing countries and assists the homeless and Native American groups in the U.S. When Richard Alpert became Ramdas, his father mocked the change, and there was an enormous rift between the hippie hero's son and the father, who had served as the president of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad and co-founded Brandeis University. Ramdas's father died last year at the age of 90, and in the last years of his life, Ramdas lived with him and cared for him when Ramdas wasn't on the road. I spoke with Ramdas in April and asked him what was responsible for the change in his relationship with his father.
Well, both of us changed. As he got older, he mellowed, he deepened, he quieted. His personality changed a lot. And I also saw that honoring him, honoring my family, was part of my route to freedom. That we had a concept of freedom in the 60s that pushed away family. We got so obsessed with independence and individualism that we lost something of the richness that comes from family. Not only don't you have built-in babysitters, but you just don't have a built-in emotional support system. And when I came back to take care of Dad and took care of my stepmother through her death and all that, I felt tremendously enriched by it. I felt that these were gifts that were given to me. And that when I turned my heart around and saw and honored the fact, there was a point in my life where I realized that I had to honor my incarnation. That it wasn't my enemy, it was my vehicle, it was my curriculum, if you will. And then he became part of my curriculum. And then getting straight with him became part of the way I got free, because as long as you push something away, it's got you.
Well, you're talking about pushing back your father. It strikes me in your own way you pushed back your own life, even by changing your name and by changing your whole public identity.
Exactly. In fact, those first years were basically a renunciate path. Of renouncing my humanity, renouncing my sexual desires, renouncing my social, my family, my nation-state identity, all of those identities. And there was a certain point where I realized that I could get high that way, but if I wanted to be free, free meant not turning away from anything. It meant being free in the midst of it all.
What did you most want to renounce about yourself, your past, you know, your identity?
I think I wanted to renounce my lack of compassion for the have-nots that came out of my middle-class fears. I think I feel, you know, people feel impoverished from their childhood for a lot of reasons. I feel impoverished from my childhood because I didn't grow up in a family that had great social concerns. I mean, we were charitable, but we weren't really caring in that way. You know,
when you first returned to the States as Baba Ram Dass after you had studied with your spiritual teacher in India, and you came here with a new name and with robes and a long beard,
none of which I have now, by the way.
Yeah, I should mention that.
For those of you who don't see me,
that's right. You're wearing civilian clothes, a trimmed mustache. Why did you don the clothes and the beard that's kind of like the prototypical guru look?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when you're new to something and you're trying to change the way you are in a social structure, if you have symbols that lead people to treat you differently, it helps. And when I walk down the street with beard and beads and barefoot and this long dress like a pharaoh, it was hard for people to treat me the way they would treat another person. And it kind of left an open space for me to adopt a new identity. It was a functional costume. It was like a chameleon type thing.
You told us a couple of the benefits of wearing, you know, the kind of guru garb. What were some of the problems that it brought? Did it bring any?
Well, the problem is the same problem that I have with the name Ram Dass now, is that it turns off a lot of people that could be people with whom I could share our shared awareness or awakening or our social concerns or our ecological concerns, that I'm seen as a cult person because of the label or the dress or the things like that. And I think it alienated people unnecessarily. I think that was part of it. I think it also made people put you into a category immediately, which then they had a set of responses or reactions to your category. And I think being more ambiguous is more interesting in terms of giving people a chance to explore new places in their own heads.
You say that Ramdas, for some people, puts you into a certain category. Didn't you at one point change your name back to Richard Alpert?
I tried, but it didn't seem to work. I was so used to being Ramdas in people's minds that my publisher didn't want to do it. They said it wouldn't sell books. And the other part of it was that Ramdas is such a beautiful name, and it means servant of God. And now, because I did How Can I Help a few years ago with Paul Gorman, a service book, which is used by nurses and doctors, I've mainstreamed in that way. And then once you mainstream, people overlook the name. It's just kind of irrelevant to them. So I'm a good guy now, so it doesn't matter. When you're a bad guy, it was another reason to be bad.
You did drop the Baba.
Yeah.
What does Baba mean, and why did you drop it?
It means kind of grandfather, elder. It's a term of respect. But all those things, like I've also dropped doctor because I'm a PhD. But all those labels, it seems to me, I just don't feel I need any labels. Why not just be right here?
Ram Dass is my guest, if you're just joining us. Can we go back a bunch of years? Let's go back to the early 60s when you were Richard Alpert and you were a professor of psychology at Harvard University and were one of the first people, and one of the very first East Coast people, to start experimenting with LSD. Mm-hmm. What use were you putting it to in your official capacity in the university?
Well, I'm a research psychologist, and that's a study of the mind, psyche, logos. And these chemicals are incredible in overriding habitual ways of seeing the universe and allowing a fresh way of perceiving. And they connected me to levels of my awareness that my Western psychological framework didn't cover. And so just as a student of the mind, I started out with that exploration. In the process of my early experience, I had what later I could acknowledge as spiritual experiences, which for a Western social scientist, spiritual stuff was seen as, like an anthropologist would see or a Freudian would see it, as sublimated something or other, or, you know, the creation of the human mind. But I really tuned into a larger context in which I exist other than my material, sensual thinking context.
So you started using LSD as part of your academic research, but once you started actually taking LSD yourself, that academic research no longer seemed relevant?
Well, I'll tell you, it was because we did studies to show, and I think that it's painful to me that in our zeal to say no to drugs, we have not differentiated between the tryptamines, for example, the psychedelics, which have potential for social change, for use. Like, we worked with prisoners in prisons where the recidivism rate is so bad. Working in marriages, working with dying people to help them extricate themselves from identification with being that which dies. There were tremendous potential uses, all of which have been, the research has been wiped out by the society's fear of drugs other than for liquor and, you know, things like that. But so our research continued to, we started in a naturalistic way because those kind of chemicals were seen in our society as psychotomimetics. That is, they were used by psychiatrists to parallel schizophrenia. And while in other cultures they were used for religious and oracular processes, and we said instead of laying a trip on them, let's just give them to people and get reports back and let's see how they use them and build a new kind of context for them. And then we began to see how set and setting were so important, that a person could have them and have a religious experience. They could use them to escape. They could use them for creative work. They could use them for therapeutic change.
You and Timothy Leary at Harvard started using LSD, and then Ken Kesey on the West Coast started using it, I think in very different ways, in a different setting. Did you have any conflicts with Kesey about what LSD should mean in the society, how it should be used?
Well, we were somewhere in the middle because there were, I mean, we had Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts and all these people. There was a community of us that were researching. And in a way, we were saying, let's keep it reasonably quiet so we can research because it's very controversial and it's going to upset the culture. At the same moment, we were opening the door at Harvard with students and so on. So we were partly responsible. Ken blew it apart in a way with the acid test because he made it a street scene And that frightened the society so much, it forced the laws, it forced legislation probably a couple of years before it would have happened. And maybe the research could have gotten more entrenched had there been a little more space.
So you still regret that that research wasn't given a chance?
Yeah, I regret it even now. I think it would be wonderful. Not us, but I mean, there are a lot of other people that could do research now.
Have you found that it's become more difficult to talk about psychedelic drugs, either in terms of the present or in terms of the research that you did in the past, in the climate today surrounding drugs, where the big fear is really around addictive drugs like crack and cocaine and heroin?
I think it is. It's certainly difficult if I talk in the mass media. There's a lot of reaction. I usually, when I have the opportunity, I really go into the issues of crack and cocaine and show the way in which they are symptoms of a malaise in our society, that in the crack issue is the lack of opportunities, economic opportunities in inner city life. And in the cocaine in the middle class, it's that they've lived out the myths where they thought they would be happy if they won, and then they don't feel that sense of contentment. And part of the myth is more will be better, so they go for the greed quality of more experience. And I think that every technological advance is open to misuse, as we have certainly learned. I mean, and psychedelics is no exception.
Ram Dass is my guest, and he's now the head of the SEVA Foundation, which is a service organization that funds health and environmental groups in developing countries. They fund homeless groups and Native American groups in the U.S. He first became known as Richard Alpert and was one of the early pioneers in LSD experimentation at Harvard University in the early 60s. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ram Dass is my guest, and you were just correcting me while our microphones were off that you are not exactly the head of the SEVA Foundation.
I'm just another member of the board. We have a rotating chairmanship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, eventually you went to India, studied with a teacher who became your spiritual teacher. Can you tell us something about him and about the kind of spiritual path you took with him?
Well, meeting him was the power of that initially was that everything that I took LSD to touch in my being, I realized he was. In fact, he actually took 900 micrograms of LSD and nothing happened to him, because it's like if you're in Detroit, you don't have to take a bus to Detroit. I mean, he was that quality. He had integrated it. So it showed me the potential that a human being, he showed me what a human being could be in terms of freedom from a fixed model of himself and a quality of love that was, I experienced as unconditional, because he was resting in a place in himself where he didn't want anything from me. He didn't want my money. He didn't want anything. He didn't want my love. He didn't want anything from me. He didn't even want me to change. He didn't want anything. And I had never been in the presence of somebody who didn't want something from me. I mean, that was a big thing for me. That opened my heart a great deal. And he died in 1973, and I would say he is the most real, I don't know how to say it, entity in my consciousness still, now. That once you have a friend like that, who has that quality of compassion and has that quality of emptiness and that quality of the giggle, the cosmic giggle, you just carry that with you, and that's the way in which he continues to influence my life.
There have been so many, both American and foreign spiritual teachers who have been responsible for terrible corruption and for many deaths.
Yeah.
In the United States, what do you think has gone wrong there? And I'm sure it's something you've thought about, because it's the kind of thing that makes people
suspicious in general of spiritual leaders.
I don't blame them. I think that Easterners that have come to the West are very vulnerable to the culture. For example, in the East, if you're a Hindu sadhu, the women and men are very segregated in the temple scene. Here, they're not. Here, women embrace you. You're not used to that if you're living in the East. You're very vulnerable. You haven't built protective devices for handling that or for learning how to socialize that or deal with it. And I think many of them just fell by the wayside. They just weren't used to the onslaught of desire provocation that our advertising, that our lifestyle is about. And I think that there is a... We in the West are so enamored of power, and a lot of yogis develop what are called siddhis or powers in the East. And they come here, and that power starts to be a card of entree to all kinds. They can read minds, they can do stuff, and then they start to use the power. And one of the rules of yoga is when you develop the powers, don't use them. Let them happen through you sometimes, but don't you use them because they will corrupt you. And I think that's where a lot of them fell, in the corruption of their intention to use their power, even when they thought they were doing it for good, by the way.
Have you had your defenses up, so to speak, because there's been, you know, the chance of a cult of personality developing around you, whether you intended it or not?
I think my guru protected me a lot. He said, Ram Dass, no ashrams, no monasteries. And what I've learned is I have no students, I have no disciples, I have no place people come to. I'm a wandering, you know, person. I just come, I feel I'm a networker. My image of myself, which I tell the audiences all the time, is I am a mouthpiece for a process a lot of us are going through. And my job is to say it well. And that's it. I'm a networking agent. I am not an enlightened being. I am not a guru. And in that way, then if they say, isn't he humble, and he is, and they project it, that's their projections, then what I have to learn to live with is not to buy other people's projections. And that's a good art for all of us to learn, how to see a projection coming at you of, oh, how great you are, or, oh, you're an irresponsible fool because you used drugs one time, and let the other people's minds projections go through you sort of like Chinese food, you know, instead of grabbing at you and holding on.
I want to talk with you a little bit about sexuality, because I know that's been an important issue throughout the different stages of your life. When you first started becoming very spiritually involved, you became celibate for a while. What was your reasons for choosing celibacy?
I think that the model of celibacy is very strong in the East, and it's based on the idea that there are certain desire systems in the human animal that are so strong that it's very hard to extricate your awareness from an identification with those desire systems. So the best thing to do is to keep away from them, to segregate yourself from them, and to deny them. Okay? Then I realized that in the West, that leads to what I call the horny celibate syndrome. Okay? And that led me to the next stage, realizing I have to have commerce with that. I have to find peace. I have to be able to acknowledge the desires without getting lost in an identification with them. And that opened me to another chapter of my life. Okay, and I'm bisexual, and that has led me, in a way, that has been extraordinary, because since my early homosexuality segregated me from the society, because when I was experiencing that in my early years, you were closeted for it. That built a lot of compassion into me for what minority group and what segregation persecution is about. It has also made me very, very open to the AIDS issue, not in a personal sense, but in the sense of being empathetic with the nature of the sexual desires that led to, for the gay community, to the predicament they find themselves in.
You've been working a lot with people who have AIDS.
And I also train buddies, and I've been helping set up hospices, for residential hospices for AIDS people to die in. I've been awed by the way in which the AIDS epidemic has opened the gay community to a quality of compassion that has just blown me away. I mean, just incredibly beautiful.
Since you spend your life trying to make sense out of things in a way, when you stand back and try to comprehend AIDS, or when someone says to you, why is this happening, as I'm sure in frustration many people have said to you. What do you think? What do you say?
I certainly mean any idea that it's retribution is off the wall as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I see it as a set of cause and effects that certain sexual patterns led to this transmission, and that leads to education, which leads to changing behavior, which leads to, I mean, I just see these. I don't get into a value judgment about the thing. I think that our sexual freedom that we espoused in the 60s led first to herpes. I mean, it led to the transmission, easy transmission of sexual disease, easy sexual transmission of diseases, because promiscuity, as the Puritan ethic started to dissolve more in this culture, a lot more sexual license occurred. And that left the door open for a lot of these subtler viruses to get transmitted. And that's shown us that we really don't have that kind of freedom, that we have to use a much more conscious way. I think it also has the potential for reawakening the qualities of love as opposed to lust, and deepening the dynamics of long-term relationships where you don't walk away so quickly.
I want to ask you a question about your father, who we were talking about earlier. He died in the past year. You had been living with him when you weren't on the road and helping to take care of him. He, I don't know how he was when he died, but at one point in his life, he was a wealthy man. Was there an inheritance, and how did you decide to use it?
My guru said to me early on, he said, "Your father has money?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Are you going to leave it to you?" I said, "Well, he's going to leave me a portion of it." He said, "You're not to accept your inheritance." I said, "Boy, that's interesting. I mean, to tell that to a Jewish boy is something, you know." I couldn't tell my father because he had raised it, you know, earned it for his kids. And he trusted me so much. He made me the executor and all of that. But what I've done is I divided what went to my brothers and my nieces and nephew. And then the rest of it I've given away.
So you never told him that you weren't going to personally accept it?
No, I felt that that would be hurting him.
So you thought it was okay to not tell him the complete truth about this?
He never asked me.
Okay.
He just assumed. But there was some subtle thing that happened between us, because the minute my guru said that, that money no longer was mine. And in some deep psychological way, that changed my relationship to my father. After that, I wanted him to spend his money. I wanted him to, you know, there was no longer my money that he was using. And I helped him get married. I gave away the bride in his second marriage. I was close friends with him. I helped them enjoy themselves as much as I could. And he sensed that. He sensed that I didn't want something from him. And I think that's why he trusted me to give me power of attorney, to make me executor, you know, as I'm not a lawyer. And so...
Not wanting something from you. That's what you said you felt towards your teacher, that he didn't want anything from
you.
Exactly. That's very important to you.
It's quite an art, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite an art.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure, Terry.
Ram Dass is the founder and chair of the Siva Foundation and the author of many books, including Be Here Now. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Oliver Stone, the director, screenwriter, and Vietnam veteran whose films include Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, and Wall Street. He's working on a new movie about Jim Morrison and the Doors. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Yiddish punchlines, tumblers, Simon Says by the Pool, and bachelor waiters serving lots of rich food. Stefan Kanfer has written a history of New York's Catskill Mountains and the vacation culture created at the mountains' resort hotels. Also, rock critic Ed Ward looks at the New York club scene that launched the careers of the Ramones, the Talking Heads, Deborah Harry, and Patti Smith. And when you think of the TV networks, what thoughts come to mind? TV critic David Bianculli gives us his impressions of CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There have been words of praise from Western countries for Soviet leader Gorbachev's agreement to allow a unified Germany to become a member of NATO. In Britain, the Foreign Office said the move was an extremely positive development in Soviet thinking. After a two-day meeting involving Gorbachev and West German Chancellor Kohl, Kohl said that he and the Soviet leader had agreed that a unified Germany should decide for itself which alliance it wants to join, and the West German leader said far-reaching progress had been reached in their talks. In Washington, the State Department has dismissed remarks by PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, who turned down U.S. demands for resuming the U.S.-PLO dialogue. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Arafat told the Arab League's foreign ministers meeting in Tunis that the PLO would not meet the key U.S. condition for resuming talks. On June 20th, President Bush broke off the U.S.-PLO dialogue and demanded that Arafat condemn Abul Abbas, the reputed mastermind of a seaborne raid on Israel. Today, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. demand has not changed.
The requirements for resumption of the dialogue were spelled out clearly by the President in his June 20th statement. And as I have said before from this podium, the most effective way for the PLO to communicate is through its actions.
However, the Arab League foreign ministers declared their support for Arafat, but said they would continue to work for a resumption of the U.S.-PLO dialogue. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
St. Louis-based McDonnell Douglas Corporation, the nation's largest defense contractor, today announced a series of layoffs and other cost-cutting measures designed to save at least $700 million. Mark Minnelli of member station KWMU has this report.
The defense and aerospace giant says it will eliminate between 14 and 17,000 mostly white-collar jobs by the end of the year, including 4,500 at company headquarters in St. Louis and 8,000 at the company's Douglas Commercial Aircraft Division in Long Beach, California. Chairman and Chief Executive Officer John McDonnell said the company regrets the hardships the move will cause for thousands of workers.
The last thing that any executive wants to consider is cutting jobs. But the hard reality is that we had to reduce our costs to be more profitable in this highly competitive and rapidly changing marketplace.
McDonnell Douglas's first quarter earnings were down 98% from the same period in 1989. McDonnell says the first round of layoffs are set to begin immediately. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Minnelli in St. Louis.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 19 points to close at 2,999.75. That's a new high on volume of some 149 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, a history of the Borscht Belt. But first, another part of New York's entertainment history. The current Escape from New York concert tour includes pioneers of punk Deborah Harry, the Ramones, and three of the four Talking Heads. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers where these performers got their start, the club CBGB.
CBGB and OMFUG, to give its full name, which stood for Country, Bluegrass and Blues and Other Music for Urban Gourmandizers, was a business that had doomed written all over it in the summer of 1975. It had a decent location on New York's Bowery, a great stage, and no customers to speak of when a young woman looking for a gig for her boyfriend's band walked in one afternoon. Now, that description may make her sound like a band bimbo, but the woman in question was Patti Smith, a poet who'd already made a record herself, a radical reworking of the Leaves' hit, Hey Joe.
Hey Joe,
she talked CBGB's owner, Hilly Crystal, into hiring was called Television, and they'd been trying to make it for some time. But New York was just coming out of the era of the cabaret card and all the laws surrounding it, which had pretty much made live rock and roll impossible. Now, however, things were changed, and Television soon became a hit at CBGB.
I don't need no justification. I was heartless.
That was them playing live there on one of their first gigs. Of course, word got out that this bohemian bar was hiring bands, and soon a strange four-piece from Long Island showed up to play. That was how the Ramones sounded on the demo tape they circulated after CBGB had made them famous. Sire Records finally signed them and gave them a much-needed producer, and in June 1976, they became the first of the CBGB bands, except for Patti Smith, of course, to release a record. And while punk rock made the headlines, it was by no means all that was on the menu at CBGB. What the media loved was stuff like what Television's ex-bass player, Richard Hell, recorded. But equally popular with the crowds was some fairly straightforward, if slightly warped, pop material.
Surf's up!
Blondie was one of the big favorites, led by Deborah Harry, who was somewhat older than most of the CBGB crowd, and who had recorded with a terrible psychedelic band called Wind in the Willows in 1969. But Blondie's songs of surfing, giant ants from Mars, and Kung Fu Girls were right on target. Another band with pop influences began as a trio, but soon added a guy whose last gig had been with the Modern Lovers, so he probably thought that his new frontman was only mildly eccentric next to Jonathan Richman, his previous employer. Jerry Harrison made Talking Heads a quartet, and the band was on their way.
When my love sticks to your love, I can't compare love. When it's not love, it's not love. It's not love, which is my. She's a building, which is on.
But these were just the stars. In 1976, Atlantic Records issued a two-album Live at CBGB's that had a blurry photo of the three-piece Talking Heads on the cover, but featured such forgotten others as Sun, Stewart's Hammer, Manster, and the Laughing Dogs. And there was Mink DeVille, who never sounded so good again.
Watch the door, deep surprise, it's a vision. My breath and rhythm sink a hollow, slash a chord.
For each lucky survivor to make the current Escape from New York tour, a dozen vanished. But at least they had had their chance to make themselves heard, courtesy of CBGB, a most remarkable club in a most remarkable time.
Rock historian Ed Ward tells us CBGB still features five or six bands a night. This is Fresh Air. Comedians Danny Kaye, Red Buttons, and Milton Berle got their start performing in the resort hotels around New York's Catskill Mountains in the 30s and 40s. But back then, they were still David Daniel Kaminsky, Aaron Schwat, and Milton Berlinger. They played a circuit of Jewish hotels that was known as the Borscht Belt. These hotels offered city dwellers more than respite from the summer heat. There was good food and plenty of it. In between meals, there were organized activities, often led by the social director, or as he was better known, the Tummler. In the book A Summer World, Stephen Camford traces the history of the Catskill resorts, beginning in 1773 with the arrival of the man known as Jacob the Jew. Camford grew up in New York City. I asked him if he ever went up to the Catskills as a kid.
I never did, no. I was forbidden the Catskills as a child because...
You were forbidden?
Yes, it was too frivolous in my family. We were a family of Romanian socialists, and you spent the summers... taking care of the poor or founding Zionist states or whatever. You certainly didn't fool around in the Catskills with all those tumblers. And, of course, as a result, I became very curious. I was also forbidden comic books as a child, and as a result, I'm one of the walking experts in comic books. So it really is a case of curiosity of the forbidden.
If you were at one of the high-end resort hotels in the Catskills in the glory days, in the late 40s or in the 1950s, and you were staying, say, at Grossinger's, a Concord, one of the big hotels. What might a typical day and typical night have been like?
Well, first of all, you would obey the Grossinger's law, which is that you shall not draw an unorganized breath. From the time you get up in the morning, your day is fixed. You would be expected to attend three meals, dressed differently for each meal. You would then probably be entertained on the lawn. In the morning, you might play tennis, you might just watch people playing tennis, you might swim, you would have a bathing suit for that. You would certainly have another bathing suit for your afternoon dip. You would have another outfit for your lunch. You would have another outfit for your supper. You would have another outfit for dancing afterwards. You would have another outfit probably for attending the theater, watching the Tummler, or watching a little Vest Pocket musical. You would probably have a canoeing outfit or a rowboat outfit for your evening relaxation on the lake, and then you'd come back, and because you'd only had three meals with about 500 choices of things, you would retire to your room where you would probably have salamis hanging like stalactites from the ceiling. Most people did.
Describe what the Tummler did at the hotel.
The Tummler would start in the morning by kidding you at breakfast and follow you throughout the day. The Tummler had about 6 hours sleep. The rest of the time he was on. He only knew two states, on and off, like a light bulb. And when he was off, he was asleep. When he was on, he was making sure that couples were constantly changing until they found the right guy or the right girl. He told jokes while you were waiting in line, perhaps for food or waiting to get a rowboat, or when you were doing calisthenics, which he would usually lead. He would tell jokes or stories of one sort or another, usually success stories about a couple whom you just missed last week who met and got married. He a doctor, she an heiress. You know. Always. They were always just, you just missed those people. That was the success stories. And then at night he entertained professionally. He was the MC. Sometimes he starred in the musicals. Sometimes he had the lead. Sometimes he had the comic role. And then at night, sometimes, like Danny Kaye, he entertained in headlights. They turned the cars into a semicircle, and he would entertain in the headlights if there was no nightlights for them.
The Tumbler was like the social director, the entertainment director. What does the word Tumbler mean?
The word Tumbler means what it sounds like. It's a man who creates a tumult. That is to say, he makes sure that no one is ever relaxed in his presence.
One of the things the Tumbler did at all of the Catskill resorts was to lead, Simon Says, usually by the pool or in the lobby. Do you have any idea how this Simon Says institution got started in the Catskills?
Most people feel that what happened was it began as a children's game and then it became a romance game. That is to say, you would do, I think everybody knows what Simon Says is, you just move according to the instructor, and if he doesn't say Simon Says and he says, do this, and you do it, you're out. And he would try to arrange it in one way or another so that in the end, one couple was left on the floor. And then he would say, Simon Says, hug. They would hug, and that was the beginning of many romances. I think that's the way it really began. And the Tumblers, it was a very easy thing for most Tumblers to do. You didn't have to be funny. You just had to get people to move their arms and move their legs. It was a combination of calisthenics and gags. And from there, they moved to telling jokes during the middle of, there's a celebrated Tumbler in Grossinger's who used to tell jokes right in the middle. He would say, do this, do that. A lady asks me about sex. I say, sex, it's a good department store. You know, he'd do those kind of lines in the middle of his routines. And sometimes they worked very well, and sometimes they didn't. In the end, I think, just as in the game itself, there was only one Simon Says game left in the Catskills, and that was indeed at Grossinger's. And now Grossinger's is out of business.
Now, one of the legacies of the Catskill resorts is the comics. I mean, so many comics came up through the ranks of the Catskill clubs.
Well, there was no minor leagues, you know, in the days of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. There were no minor leagues except the Catskills and smaller nightclubs. And in the Catskills, you had the freedom to fail. Joan Rivers said that the Catskill audiences were the worst in the world, the hardest on her. She used to say that she would appear at some resorts where they spoke only Yiddish. She spoke only English. So a translator would come in, and she said every line bombed twice. But nevertheless, she learned. She got tough because of it, and Buddy Hackett learned that way, and Alan King learned that way. The most famous of the Tumblers who made it big was Danny Kaye, who started in a little resort called White Row, and the next thing you know, he was offered an MGM contract. And Jerry Lewis started as really a kid. I think he was 15 or 16 years old at Brown's. And Sid Caesar, who really sponsored a great many humorists, like Woody Allen, who wrote for him, and Mel Brooks, they all began in the Catskills. And they probably hated it, and they certainly never went back, but it taught them what they knew. It taught them an awful lot about timing. Jackie Mason learned everything he knew about timing.
There was a whole subculture of the waiters and busboys mm-hmm. at the hotels, and even if you only know the Catskills through Dirty Dancing, you will have picked up on that. How did the waiters end up being the young single guys?
There was never enough single men. There never have been enough single men at any resort anywhere in the world. And so what they used to do, the owners would do, is get waiters, and they would screen them pretty carefully too, who were in college, so that they were presented as, this young man will be a lawyer next year. This young man is going to be a doctor someday. And so the girls would come up, even though these were only waiters, they had somebody to dance with and somebody who has had a future. And for many people, if you really realize how many of the customers were immigrants or the sons and daughters of immigrants, this was the only way they could move socially. They were from Lower East Side background, not very much money, socially at the bottom of the American ladder, and they could marry up. So all of these waiters and busboys represented a kind of a key to the door, a way out into America, and it worked.
As a resort area, the Catskills have changed immensely in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. What were some of the reasons for a lot of the hotels and country clubs closing up?
Well, I've traced it to a few things. One, I think, you may doubt this, but it really is true. The invention of the air conditioner, because it meant that summers were not as insupportable. You could stay in the Bronx in July and you wouldn't die, whereas formerly you thought you would. You thought you'd just melt and run down into a sewer. And the other thing is really much deeper and more important, and that is success is what undid the Catskills. For one thing, anti-Semitism subsided. For another, people were able to afford more expensive vacations. You could go to Europe. You could go to Florida. You could even go to Israel. And gradually, the Catskills began to be perceived as something your grandparents or your parents did. You didn't want to do that. So the Catskills is really undone by success. It is very much an American story of assimilation and integration into American life.
Mm-hmm. When it was clear that the clientele wasn't coming like they used to the Catskill resorts, what are some of the changes that the owners made to try to attract more customers?
There are two things I could tell you about. One was, of course, Italian night, which is always shocking to me. I mean, the idea that they would have Polish and polka nights and other things. But one of the things that sort of surprised me, I went to the Concord in doing some research on the book, and the first thing I saw, this is the Concord has a place that has a synagogue built right within it, and I went inside, and there on sort of a black felt sign, you know, with the movable white letters, it said, "Welcome, Blue Shield, Blue Cross." And that, to me, said it all. I mean, these are now resorts that cater largely to conventions of businessmen and sales forces and the like. So that's what they've tried to do. They've tried to make it a convention business, no longer the simple Jewish nuclear family. They can't make it simply on that, the few that are still surviving.
So if you go to the Catskill resorts now, what else are you going to see?
You'll see ethnics of one sort or another. You will see Hasids. You will see blacks. You will see Hispanics. You'll see a very different kind of resort. This isn't to say that there are no Jews up there. The Jews have settled in the towns. You'll see Jewish police chiefs and Jewish firemen and Jewish store owners and administrators of all kinds. But you're not ever going to see, I think, the old kind of Jewish resort again, because those people, except perhaps for the influx of Russian Jews that are coming to the United States now, those people are gone. They're into American life.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Canfer is the author of A Summer World. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the meeting between Mikhail Gorbachev and Helmut Kohl?
Well, big news that the Soviets have withdrawn their objections to Germany being in NATO, all of Germany, after unification. It's a change. The Germans have made some concessions about the size of their forces and where they can be within the country, but a big concession by Moscow and Gorbachev. Also, news today about a new appraisal of the U.S. deficit. It's bigger, $64 billion or so bigger than was thought a few months ago. Layoffs, 17,000 layoffs by McDonnell Douglas coming through the latter half of this year. And a special report on the future of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and the future of the black community there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. All the major TV networks offer pretty much the same fare: news, specials, made-for-TV movies, drama, and comedy shows. But not all networks handle all those genres equally well. TV critic David Bianculli thought it was time for a network scorecard.
10 years ago, if you tried to describe the networks in a few words or a few shows, it'd go something like this. ABC would be the jiggle network, with lots of toss-away fluff like Charlie's Angels. CBS, even though it had the Dukes of Hazzard and Dallas, was still known as the quality network, thanks to such prestige shows as Lou Grant. And NBC would be the nothing network, filled with rancid shows like The Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo and Games People Play, that show with Brian Gumbel and dwarf tossing. Things changed quickly, though, because NBC came up with one show, Hill Street Blues, that snatched the quality crown away from CBS. By the mid-80s, NBC was the undisputed quality network, ABC was the nothing network, and CBS didn't know what it was. So what identities have the networks adopted so far in 1990? Think of it as a word association test. What's the first thing or the first show that pops into your mind when I say ABC, or NBC, or CBS, or Fox? Let's compare results. I'm not saying that I'm right and you're wrong, but since I'm talking and you're listening, I've got the home court advantage. When I think of ABC, I think of Twin Peaks, and as a result, I automatically give ABC the quality network label for 1990. Twin Peaks does for ABC exactly what Hill Street Blues did for NBC a decade ago. Gives people who don't normally get excited about TV a reason to tune in again. With NBC, I still think of L.A. Law, Cheers, and The Cosby Show. Even though those are all wonderful programs, that's not wonderful news for NBC, because all of those series are at least 6 years old. NBC hasn't been able to add hot new shows to its schedule for years, which makes the number one network vulnerable to a takeover. Call it the old network. With the Fox Broadcasting Network, the easy answer is The Simpsons, which, with Married with Children, makes Fox the new network. Young, sassy, and lots of fun. Fox wasn't here 10 years ago, but 10 years from now, it might even be on top. That leaves CBS. When I think of CBS, I try to think of Wise Guy, but even that doesn't work anymore. Now when I think of CBS, this is what I get. It's the sound of silence, and it means that CBS has no image at all. It's the new nothing network. And where TV is concerned, anything's better than nothing.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Ron Barron. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and director Oliver Stone gives us a preview of his forthcoming film, On the Doors. And he tells us about the personal experiences that led to his most acclaimed film, Platoon. Also, a talk with one of the first black feature film directors in America, Melvin Van Peebles. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Stay tuned for an evening full of music on Evening Classics. We'll be hearing the Fourth Symphony by Schubert tonight. Also Bruckner's Mass in E Minor for choir and wind ensemble, plus some chamber music of Mozart and some of Edvard Grieg's music for the play Peer Gynt. That's all coming up tonight on 91 FM, and I invite you to stay tuned.